Psalm 106, 34 through 40. And it reads, "They did not destroy the peoples concerning whom the Lord had commanded them, but they mingled with the Gentiles and learned their works. They served their idols, which became a snare to them. They even sacrificed their sons and their daughters to demons and shed innocent blood, the blood of their sons and daughters, whom they sacrificed to the idols of Canaan, the land that was polluted with blood. Thus they were defiled by their own works and played the harlot by their own deeds. Therefore, the wrath of the Lord was kindled against his people, so he abhorred his own inheritance."
Well, welcome everyone who's here this morning. And it feels like it's been a long time since I've been up here. Of course, last Sunday we had Wes Gossett visiting with us and brought us a couple of excellent lessons. And the Sunday before that, on Sunday evening, my head was about to blow apart. So several of the young guys filled in and helped me out. So it feels like a while since I've been up here. But good to see everybody. And if you're visiting with us, as Percy said, I'd like to invite you personally to come back and be with us again. We meet again this evening at 6 o'clock. And we would love to have you back with us. This morning, I'm going to go back and pick up part two of a lesson that I did last month. And I said, indeed, that I would come back with a second part of it this month. So I will do that. I'm going to talk about, reprehensible Christianity. You may remember we put a definition of reprehensible up here. Something that's reprehensible is, in fact, culpable. It deserves blame. It's blamable, and it deserves the blame it gets, the condemnation, the reproach, the censure, words like that are used about it. Now, how in the world could Christianity be found to be reprehensible? I asked you in the bulletin this morning one of the questions, if you picked up one of those, do you find Christianity reprehensible, and is there anything you find within it reprehensible? Well, people do. And so we're taking a look, kind of examining, not by any means, every charge that's ever made against it, but we're looking at some examples of the kinds of things that people do charge Christianity with. You may remember that this grew out of, last month I pointed this out, this grew out of a debate that Kyle Butt, who is an associate editor for Reason and Revelation, that he had with two young atheists. In that debate, they charged that Christianity is reprehensible, and they based that on certain observations. You may remember that. I talked a little bit about it. What was surprising, perhaps, in the debate to many was that Butt acknowledged the truth of a lot of their charges. They said Christianity is reprehensible. He said you're right. They kind of found that interesting, and many do. But as Butt goes on to explain why he says such, it becomes apparent to us exactly what he's saying. I believe that is helpful, regardless of the debate. I think it is helpful for us to note what atheists find so reprehensible about Christianity. This morning, I'm going to take a look not by any means at everything that we could talk about. I'm not so much going to talk about it. You may remember in the first lesson, we noted various biblical misrepresentations, doctrines, and so forth, that certain Christian beliefs, quote unquote, that people have, and they're indeed reprehensible. They're inconsistent with what the Bible teaches. In many cases, they're illogical, etc. We talked about certain things like that, like, for example, theistic evolution, trying to believe in evolution and the Bible at the same time. You can't do that. And so someone comes along and charges how ludicrous that is, and they're right. And that's the kind of thing that Butt was assenting to. This morning, I'm going to take a look at, in particular, I'm going to pay special attention to certain actions that are found among Christians that skeptics readily charge are reprehensible. And when I say that, and especially if you picked up the bulletin, you may see where I'm going with this, and certain things may come to you, even if you didn't, certain things might immediately pop to your mind. I want you to kind of focus a little bit on what I'm saying, and you can just look at the slide up here. It's been interesting to me, sad, but interesting, over the last 30 years or so, especially since I left Florida College, it's been interesting to me to watch what I call my generation of young people. No longer young, obviously, but young people we were when we left FC. And especially the group of guys, I went down there, of course, after making a decision to preach. I went down there to study and to be around other young preachers and so forth. And it's been interesting for me to watch what's happened to that group, the majority of them. There are very few of them, and I've said that from the pulpit before, there are very few of them that are faithful any longer. There are very few of them that preach any longer. And even if they do preach, they're not faithful gospel preachers. They may be in some denomination or whatever it might be. But it's been interesting for me to watch what's happened to them and the reasons why they charge, you know, what we practice, myself and others. Even a brother-in-law of mine is in that group. And to watch what they charge Christians with, what they say about us as a group, and to try to be fair, to acknowledge where it's right and where it's wrong. This particular segment, or this particular part of this sermon, as I was preparing it, a lot of it is fueled by contact that I made a couple of weeks ago, around Thanksgiving, but a couple of weeks ago with one of those young men, one of those young guys. I'd in fact been reaching out to him for over 25 years, literally. And whenever I would find where he was and what he was doing, I'd send him an email or try to call him on the phone, and never got a response. He wouldn't talk to me on the phone. He wouldn't answer an email, but I'd keep sending them, you know. And Thanksgiving, that week of Thanksgiving, all of a sudden, I get this invitation on Facebook, you know, be my friend. And so we've had very brief, but we've had the first contact we've had in over 25 years, literally. He is now a self-proclaimed agnostic. And he is the son of a very, and I won't call his name, but he is the son of a fairly well-known gospel preacher. What happens to someone? What is it that, each case is different to be sure. But there are some commonalities. Whenever you talk to someone like this, and you begin to say, what happened? Why did you turn against what I practice? I may not say it like that, but that's really what I'm thinking. Why did you turn against it? And you do begin to hear some common charges. In fact, the first one I'll put up, and by far that I'll spend the most time with, is probably the number one charge that comes rolling out of someone like this. It comes rolling out of their mouth. They find certain things we do reprehensible. They make charges. They charge us with being a certain way. And the question for us is not, are they, and that's what we tend to do. I tend to do that. You're not being fair, and to ask myself, is that person being fair? And just say simply, no, they're not, and dismiss it. The question goes further than that, and the question really would come down, and I won't look at the passage, but would really come down to what Paul was saying to Peter in Galatians chapter 2. You have to examine yourself, Peter. When you're going to tell other people how to live, if you're going to tell other people how to live, and if you're going to say to other people you have to live a certain way, then it's got to come down to you making a judgment about yourself. And ask yourself, be critical, even more critical, if you will, than the person who's making the charge against you. Be even more critical than he would be to see if indeed any of it is justified. Now, having said all of that, you can probably tell where I'm going, so let me just make the first charge that they make. Their charge, almost universally, is that Christians are hypocrites. And the point of it is, if Christians are hypocrites, what is a hypocrite? We give a lot of definitions of it, but the root word of hypocrisy, oddly enough, means to judge. The root word of hypocrisy is judgment. And the idea really is that a hypocrite makes bad judgments. He says he is one thing, but in fact he's another. He says he lives, for example, like one thing, but the judgments that he makes that really guide his life are something else. In short, he says he's one thing, but he really is not. What he is, the whatever, the person charging, making the charge, the atheist or the agnostic or the unfaithful brother or whatever it might be, that person is charging, you're no better than I am. You live the same way I live, yet you look at me and tell me to live a different way. You're a hypocrite. And that's what you generally hear out of people. In fact, if I had to say what is the number one charge that's made by unfaithful people, especially brethren who've left the truth, they will point back at me and say, you're a hypocrite. And that's been said over and over and over. And it's not so much even, sometimes at least, it's not so much that the person is looking at my life. They're just looking at all of us. And they really want to say everybody's a hypocrite. All Christians are hypocrites. So why should I claim to be any different? Now, when members of the Lord's church strive to, quote unquote, be like everyone else, I believe they elicit, and I believe they rightfully elicit this charge. Here's what I mean. There's a tendency within all of us. I think we all, quote unquote, want to fit in. I know that growing up, a lot more so than it is now. I really, you know, they say the older you get, the less you care, and I guess that's the truth, you know. But I know that when I was younger, I wanted to fit in. I didn't want to be the oddball. I didn't want to be the one, and I usually ended up being, no matter what I tried to do, but I didn't want to be the guy that everybody pointed a finger at and said, you know, look at that freak over there in the corner. I didn't want to be that person. I wanted to fit in. And there's a tendency, I believe, within all of us to want to be like everybody else. We want to kind of blend in. We don't want to stand out, because if we do, then we're going to be the subject to, if not the object, of ridicule, etc. So what happens is that Christians, members of the Lord's church, begin to, as I put up here, conduct themselves like everyone around them. And when you look to the Bible, it's not surprising that God would have laws about that. If you'll open to the book of Leviticus, and I'm not going to do a lot of commentary on these passages, but I do want to read them. Look at Leviticus chapter 20, God warning his people before he carried them into the promised land. In Leviticus 20, drop down with me, if you will, in verse 24. But I have said unto you, you shall inherit their land, and I will give it to you to possess it. A land that flows with milk and honey. I am the Lord your God, which have separated you. Notice the language. Have separated you from other people. You shall therefore put difference between clean beast and unclean, between unclean fowls and clean. And you shall not make your souls abominable by beast or by fowl or by member or by any manner, rather, of living thing that creepeth upon the ground, which I have separated from you as unclean. And ye shall be holy unto me, for I, the Lord, am holy, and have severed you from other people, that you should be mine. Now, regardless of how outdated that is, and I realize the laws of clean and unclean meats and all of that have changed. That's not what's important. The point that is still the same is that God separates his people to himself. And God expects his people to be separate. He expects them to be severed, as it were, from the world around them. Yet people, if you'll turn over to 1 Samuel chapter 8, people always are the same. And when you see in 1 Samuel chapter 8, and if you look down at verses 19 and 20, people want to be like everybody else. It says here in 1 Samuel 8, verse 19, nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel. And they said, no, but we will have a king over us. Why? Why did they want a king? Well, that we may also be like all the nations. What are they saying? We want to be like everybody else. We don't want to be different. We don't want to be separate. We don't want to be, as it were, severed. The truth is, and I know this is going to sound hard, but the truth is, we don't want to be holy. We want to be like everybody else. Now, here it was with respect to who governed them, who governed over them. We want a king like everybody else. Look at the passage that Bob read for us. I'm not going to reread all of that, but I do want to point out two verses in Psalm 106 and emphasize them. So go back with me, if you will, to Psalm 106 and start with me in verse 34. And you'll notice in this passage, again, very similarly, we're going back and forth here. But anyway, notice when God says they went in, and Bob read this, but they went into the land, they didn't do what God commanded. God meant for them to eradicate the land. And I mean to rid it of all those ungodly people and all of their ungodly practices, as it were. Now notice what happens when it says in verse 35, there's a line there in particular, when it says they were quote unquote mingled among the heathen. Now you know what it means to mingle. If we went into a social gathering and someone said to you, mingle, mingle, you know, what that means is get out there in the crowd, get with those people, do what those people do, talk to them, etc., etc. It just means be part of the crowd, be part of the group. Now here what happened was God's people disobeyed him and they went into the land, and rather than ridding the land of the people and their practices, they mingled. You'll notice also as it goes on here to describe how they began to join in, even to the point of the idolatry and all of that kind of thing. Drop down to verse 39. Thus were they, quote unquote, defiled with their own works. Now the works of the heathen, the practices of the ungodly nations, have become their own. What happens when people look at Christians, the people on the outside, even if they have left us to join them, and now they're pointing a finger back at us, or back at me, and they're saying, you're a hypocrite. They're finding fault with me because I've mingled. They're finding fault with me because I've adopted the practices of other people. Now they're mine. It's not that they're saying, it's what the guy down the street does that I find so reprehensible. It's what you do that I find reprehensible. You live just like them. So how do you come to me and tell me how to live when you live just like that? It is reprehensible. The Bible is replete with passages. The New Testament is replete with passages that talk about hypocrisy. Really, if you will, it talks about the bad judgments that even God's people make. Look at Matthew chapter 23. Now, Jesus made it clear here what a hypocrite is in very simple language. In fact, in we'll read several verses here. Well, let me go back to verse 3. He says, all therefore whatsoever they bid you observe. This were the teachers, the preachers, and so forth of the day. What they tell you to do, do it. But don't do what they do. Why? Because they say and do not. Look again at verse 5. All their works they do for to be seen of men. It's like putting on a show. It's like, I want the world to think I'm godly, so what do? Well, I put a suit on. And that kind of says to the world, hey, he's a preacher, or he's a Christian or whatever. And I dress a certain way. I say certain things. I do certain things so people will point a finger and say, that's a Christian. But in fact, as you go on to read this, and you look down, for example, verse 25, the truth is, they're hypocrites. In verse 25, woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. Why? Because you make clean the outside of the cup and the platter, but within is full of extortion and excess. It'd be like someone like me, for example, that makes sure that, let's make sure I've got a nice looking tie on, my coat's clean, let's make sure my hair's done right, but inside me is full of filth. That's a hypocrite. That somebody's cleaned up the outside, but inside is just as filthy as anyone else ever dreams of being. And the person is right when he points a finger and says, hypocrite. It's reprehensible. You're telling me how to live, you live no differently. And he goes on here. Thou blind Pharisee, cleanse first that which is within the cup and platter, that the outside of them may be clean also. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. For you're like unto whited sepulchres. These are like very cleaned up, like the tombs we see around here in the graveyards. It's like cleaning the outside and painting it and so forth to make it look beautiful. But within, what is inside, is a dead person. It's full of dead man's bones and all uncleanness. We understand what Jesus is saying. There's got to be a cleanup, so to speak, of the whole person. Not just what other people might see from time to time. You go back to the book of Proverbs, and I'd like for you to do that with me, in Proverbs chapter 11, and hear something that was said here. the wisdom of Solomon here, but Proverbs 11 and verse 9. A hypocrite, and this is very important, a hypocrite with his mouth destroys his neighbor. When you read that, that really should scream at me as a Christian. The power that I have. You'll notice what it's saying here. I may tend, and I hope you're all listening, because we all, myself especially, we need to hear this. I can tell people, and I can feel good that I have the truth that can help somebody go to heaven. And sometimes I do feel good about that. But the truth is, and what God is really saying here is, that I have the power, not just with the truth I preach, but with the hypocrisy that I preach. I have the power to destroy my neighbor. But because my neighbor may hear both things coming out of my mouth, you know, like the old Indian would say, he speaks with forked tongue, you know. But what would come out of my mouth? And he may hear me say godly things. He may hear me say there's a heaven and a hell, a God in heaven. We all need to do what's right and live right so we go to heaven. He may hear me say all of that. But when he hears me say things like, I want to be like the rest of the world, and I want to sin like you sin, and I want to do all those things you do, and I am just like you. He hears that, and whether he says it to me or not, he sums that up correctly. You're a hypocrite. And every Christian I've ever known is a hypocrite. And if that's all Christianity is just a pile of hypocrisy, why should I fake it too? And that's what he's saying. With the mouth, the hypocrite has the power to destroy his neighbor. God is warning us. In passages like Matthew 7, and I won't reread that, you've seen it in the bulletin recently, but this is the passage that says, if you're going to point out that little speck in your neighbor's eye, your brother's eye, pull the beam out of your own. You hypocrite, Jesus charged. You that would judge, correctly even, that there's something wrong with your brother. First, look at yourself. Look in the mirror. What's in your own eye? What's easy to see? What's the hypocrisy that's easy to see in your own life that needs to be cleaned up? Jesus often charged hypocrisy and made it a point to his disciples to be concerned with themselves and cleaning up their lives so that they demonstrated to the world that separate idea that he was talking about in Leviticus. That idea of being severed from the world, etc. Finally, Jesus taught us, and if you look with me at John 15, and on surface, this may not look like a passage that goes with it, but I want you to listen carefully to what Jesus is saying to his disciples here. John 15, and look down at verses 18 and 19. Now, he's talking about what they can expect as they live their Christian lives. He says, if the world hate you, now notice that. You don't fit in. I mean, you live the kind of life that's respectable. You live the kind of life that really is a city set on a hill, a light that would attract people, the ones who will be looking for the light. But other than that, you don't fit in. And you are not like everybody else, and so the world is going to hate you for that. And if the world hates you, you know that it hated me before it hated you. Why? Verse 19. If you were of the world, Christians are not. They are not of the world. If you were of the world would love his own. The truth is, because you are not of the world, but I have chosen you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. Now really the question for me is, does the world hate me? And, you know, for me personally, yeah, they do. But the point is, do they hate me, and do they hate me for the right reason? I mean, is it that my life is such that I fit in the world so well, I jive with the world so well, that you know what, people, they don't hate me. They don't dislike me whatsoever because I'm one of theirs. You know, I'm one of them, they're one of me, etc., all that kind of stuff. Is that the truth? Because if it is, I haven't achieved what Jesus is talking about here. If it is that the world looks at me from time to time as being a little odd, being different, not living like they live, not running where they run, not doing what they do, if that's what they see, then I'm living the way Jesus is talking about right here. And that's something for you to judge of yourself. Are you a hypocrite or are you not? Jesus goes on to say very similarly in chapter 17 and verse 14, he prays for his disciples because, quote unquote, they are not of the world. He's chosen them out of the world. 1 John 2 and verse 15, the very well-known passage, love not the world, neither the things of the world. Christians don't. They don't love the world, they're not part of it. If they are, then the world charges hypocrite. In 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verses 14 through 17, and I won't turn there, but you may want to go home and study this passage. Be not unequally yoked. A lot of times people look at that passage and say, oh, that's marriage. Don't marry a non-Christian. It's fine if you want to apply it to that, but it really ain't what Paul is talking about. Paul is talking about something that goes a lot further than that. He's talking about the way we live, the companions we have, the people that we are the closest to, and the actions and activities and so forth that we share with them. And what Paul is saying is that a Christian just does not have that kind of strong tie where it's yoked together. In other words, like a team of oxen, they pull in the same direction. And if you are with someone in the world, or many people in the world, pulling in the same direction, then you're all headed to the same place. But if in your life, as you're yoked together with them, friends and family and so forth that are not Christians, there's that always that pulling. You're the oxen that wants to pull the other way. And there's always that pulling. Well, then you're living the Christian life. And everybody around you will feel it. Come out from among them and be you separate, is what the passage says. When I talk to people like my friend that I contacted for the first time a couple of weeks back, I know the kinds of things he's going to say. I know what he was saying over 25 years ago and led him to where he is today. And I know that when he looked in the world around him, he saw a lot of hypocrisy. And what I have to try to convince him of is this. You're right. I have to admit to you, you're right. There's a lot of hypocrisy in me. There's a lot of hypocrisy in a lot of other members of the church. But the truth is, there is a group of people, no matter how small, there's a group of people that are really trying to live holy lives, and you need to be one of those. That's a very difficult sell, if you will. But it's the one we have to make. And we have to be one of the ones that demonstrate that. I'll go through quickly the second couple of points. They're very basic, and they won't need a lot of passages to demonstrate the point. The charge that's made is Christians are prejudiced. Prejudice is one of the things that the world hates. And right now, I mean, society changes all the time. But right now, society hates prejudice about as much as anything. Prejudice is not politically correct. There are times when it has been, but it's not now. And that's good. I'm glad it's not. Now, sometimes it's misplaced. The idea is on something's branded as prejudice when really it's a righteous stand against sin. But the truth is, prejudice is wrong. And especially, and let's just make the point, when members of the church, like everybody else, show partiality or a prejudice for someone or against someone. And notice what I said here, as a result of unrighteous bias. Now, I'm biased against, for example, child pornography. Not only do I take a stand against it, but I'm very biased against it. It hurts children. It's a rape of children. So I'm against it. And I'm very prejudiced, so. But it's a righteous bias. And you understand that. There are things that we are righteously biased against. But for me to be biased or prejudiced or whatever for a certain ethnic group of people, against a certain group of people of a skin color, or for a certain nation and against a certain nation or nationality, or all of those kinds of things, obviously it's wrong. Obviously God teaches that that is ungodly. And when we are, in fact, a number of passages, Proverbs 24 and verse 23, just simply says, as straightforward as it possibly can say, that all respect of persons or all showing of partiality, depending on your translation, are all prejudice. It's just wrong. It's just absolutely wrong. These other passages as well teach that. I'm not going to go through every single one of them. The point in John 7 and verse 24, if you're still in the book of John, I'd like for you to go back and look at that passage with me. Because sometimes, and this is what happens in the world, you may turn on tomorrow, turn on one of these talk shows, and there may be any what kind of person sinning and doing whatever ungodly thing they may be doing. And somewhere in the course of that discussion, somebody will say, well, you know, the Bible says even, judge not, don't judge, don't judge me and all of that. That's not what Scripture teaches. And you might say, well, Michael, I know that's what Scripture teaches. Judge not. That's right. Judge not that you be not judged. That Matthew 7 passage. But really, what God teaches is exactly this. Look at John 7 and verse 24. If we put all the passages together. Jesus, in fact, said in John 7, 24, judge not according to appearance. If I'm judging a person as being the kind of person I don't want anything to do with because his skin is black, or whatever it might be, well, obviously that's ungodly. It's sinful. On the other hand, if I'm judging an action of a person, let's say that a person is a murderer, and I say that person's a murderer and therefore is wrong, that's not unrighteous judgment. And I'm not judging according to appearance. I'm judging according to action. And you'll hear what Jesus says here, judge not according to the appearance, but judge righteous judgment. Sometimes people want to say, I'm a homosexual, don't judge me. Even the Bible teaches you Christians not to judge. No, it doesn't. It teaches me not to judge you if you're a fat homosexual for saying you're fat and I don't like you. If you're a black homosexual for being black and I don't like you. But if you're a homosexual, you're sinning, you're doing what God condemns, and that's righteous judgment for me to say, not that I don't like you, but that what you're doing is wrong. Just as it would be right for you to turn back on me, and if there is some action that I'm doing that you find is hypocritical or against what God says, you'd be just as right to point that out. Judge righteous judgment. So when people say, even Christians are prejudiced, well, exactly what do you mean? Because I know you're right. I know a lot of people out there are prejudiced for all the wrong reasons. A lot of members of the church are, and that's wrong. It's reprehensible. But when you're saying, you know, we judge against certain actions, yes, well, maybe God does as well. That's not hypocritical, and it's not being prejudiced. In Galatians 2, the passage I alluded to earlier, I read this recently. I won't turn there and read it again. But this is the passage where Paul confronted Peter. Peter, when there were no Jews here, it was all right for you to eat with Gentiles. You were fine with that. Barnabas too. And then certain people came from some prominent Jews and you said, oh boy, can't be seen with them. Well, that's being a hypocrite. And in fact, it's being a prejudiced hypocrite. And in fact, Paul pointed out to Peter, you know, neither prejudice nor hypocrisy has a place in Christianity. In fact, in James chapter 2, passage we studied this summer in our study of James, you know, that was the passage where a really nicely dressed guy and a really poorly dressed guy came into the same assembly, and some Christians said, oh, let's pay attention to the rich guy and let's hate the poor guy. Well, it's prejudice. And the Lord doesn't want us to have our faith with any respect of persons. It's just wrong, is the point. I'd like for you to read with me one passage. It is interesting. In Jude, probably don't often turn to the book of Jude when we're talking about prejudice, but it is an interesting passage. Jude 16. And you'll notice one of the things that Enoch, all the way back before the flood, Enoch condemned. These are murmurers, complaining, these ungodly people. You can read the passage. These are murmurers and complainers, walking after their own lust and their mouth speaking great swelling words. And then notice one of the things he said. Having men's persons in admiration because of advantage. Now, boy, that's outdated King James language. But here's what he was saying. The idea is they show partiality, they show prejudice to get advantage. You know, most people in the world do that, don't they? Most people, we call it buttering up the boss sometimes. We treat the boss or somebody in power a little differently than we treat the common guy we meet on the street. If a guy has position, a wealth, a power, or whatever it might be, we really want to, you know, kind of show respect for that person. Because of some advantage we might get along the way. But we're always asking the question, what can you do for me? And if you can't, if you're just not in a position to really do very much for me, I won't have very much for you. And that's exactly what Jude is talking about here. The idea of being prejudiced and biased and having respect of persons because of an advantage I might get. If I'm always asking the question, what can I get out of this person or what can they do for me? And that's going to determine how I treat them. And the atheist out there that points a finger and says, that's reprehensible. You're right. It surely is. Because Jesus treated everybody the same. Didn't matter how poor, how rich, how tall, how short, how black or how white. Jesus treated everybody the same. Because what was important, what still is important to Jesus, is the soul inside. Not whoever we are on the outside. Lastly, and I'll do this one very quickly. A lot of times people charge, Christians are unloving. They don't even love each other. And what happens is they witness Christians fighting, always fighting. In fact, one of the charges I used to hear back home, because churches of Christ were a lot more well-known than up here. I mean, there was a lot fewer people and there were a lot more of them. So, you know, and everybody was kind of related to everybody and knew everybody. So if we had trouble at reunion, everybody knew about it. You'd go to the grocery store or the cleaners or wherever you might go and somebody would be saying, here you guys having trouble down there. That's the truth. I mean, you think I'm exaggerating. I'm not exaggerating. It's the truth. So you always knew, and maybe it was a good thing, because you always knew if we're going to fight and be unloving and be ungodly, not love each other, not be the way we're supposed to be, the whole world's going to know about it, and how are we ever going to get anybody to come here? So it kind of made you be on your best behavior. Not always, but I think it pushed us a little bit. Maybe sometimes we think because we're isolated, maybe we're kind of lost in a sea of people in a place like this. It's okay if we come here and just treat each other like dirt. Hate each other. Carry on our hatred for years and years and years. I have hated that person across from me on the other side of the building for 22 years and I'm not stopping now. And when people are aware of that, let's say you have a brother or a niece or a nephew or a next door neighbor. And they're aware of that. What do they think? Jesus hadn't done much for you. What should he be able to do for me? They look around and they see people in the world and everybody hates everybody else. You walk down the street, you look at people's faces. Maybe this time of year, like James pointed out, it's a different time of year. So everybody has that spirit about them. Whoopee! But you walk down the street or you drive down the street and everybody is just full of hate for everybody else. So much so that it just depresses you to the point that you get tired of living. I do. I don't know about you. But when the world is looking at me and saying, you don't love any more than anybody else. You don't have any more love in you. You people don't have any more love, not even for each other. Much less for everybody. Christians are supposed to love everybody. Why should they want to be part of what we are? It's reprehensible, the atheist says. Some of my friends have said to me, you know, God is love. You believe that, Michael? Yeah, I believe that. You know the book, chapter, and verse where it is? Sure do. God is love. Love everybody. You're supposed to love one another. You sing songs like, love one another. And I've had them just ridicule me. Singing that song back at me. So what do you think about when you sing that song? Do you think about every member of the church that you hate? It's hard. That's a hard thing to answer. Because we know it's the truth. The Bible certainly teaches us. Leviticus 19:18, love one another. It's been part of God's law since the old law. And it's quoted. In fact, Jesus said it's one of those great commandments. The second is like unto it. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. It becomes the defining mark of Christianity. I'm going to close, and I'd like for you to turn with me to John 13. Now, I'll put another passage up here, but I'm going to close by reading this one. When Jesus was about to go to the cross, One of the last things, right after instituting the Lord's Supper, and one of the last things that Jesus said to the disciples was this. Little children, verse 33. Little children, yet a little while I'm with you. You shall seek me, and as I said unto the Jews, whither I go, you cannot come. So now I say to you, a new commandment I give unto you, that you love one another, as I have loved you, that you also love one another. And by this shall all men know that you are my disciples, if you have love one to another. You hear what Jesus is saying? Jesus is saying it's the defining mark. It's what people are going to judge. It's what an atheist is going to look at you to see. Are you loving? Or are you not? We see a number of passages that teach us. But in fact, what the world tends to see is in Galatians 5. Now, I intend to do a sermon from Galatians 5, so I'm going to leave this for right now. The idea of the passage is this. By love, serve one another. But if all you do is just eat each other up, you're going to eat each other right out of existence. And I'll leave that thought with you. We'll come back and study that passage. Reprehensible Christianity. Christianity is the only logical, consistent faith in the world. I believe that. I believe it's supported by evidence and it's reasoned by people like us who are proponents of it. And yet Christianity is obscured to others by the various beliefs and false suppositions that we sometimes have, we hold on to, we can't defend. But maybe more importantly, by the inconsistencies that we have in our lives when we claim to practice Christianity. And finally, we have to do everything we can to exemplify true Christianity instead of what the world would say is reprehensible.